I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, House Democrats put pressure on Vice President Pence and what's left of the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from office. They released an article of impeachment charging Trump with, quote, incitement of insurrection in response to the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters last week. Members of Congress and their staff were forced into hiding while Capitol Police were overwhelmed by the mob, some of whom called for Pence to be hung. The House will vote tomorrow on impeachment, which is expected to pass, and the FBI has warned of further attacks on D.C. and state capitals leading up to Joe Biden's inauguration next Wednesday. Joining us is Catherine Lucey, who covers the White House for the Wall Street Journal. She used to report for the Philadelphia Daily News. And Catherine Lucey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
So what has the White House response been to this one article of impeachment which was released yesterday?
So we haven't heard a lot directly from the White House yet. What we know, obviously, is that the president, who has been robbed of his Twitter account and his social media, has been kind of cut off. So he has not directly responded, but we know privately he has been upset with how things have gone since Wednesday. He has been frustrated. He thinks he has been betrayed by allies. He is upset with media personalities he thinks who are not supporting him. He's been frustrated with other fallouts for his personal business and things like that. He is heading today to Texas, to a town on the border, to do an event that's meant to highlight his efforts to build a border wall, which is part of a push from some people around him to try and get him to do some things in these sort of tumultuous closing days of his presidency. So we do expect to hear from him there, though how directly he will address this and whether he will take questions, we will have to see how that unfolds. Another thing that we know from yesterday also is just that he and Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, did meet for the first time yesterday since the attack. They had not been speaking, and there was a lot of consternation around the vice president about the way he had been treated by the president, a lot of frustration there. But officials are saying that they had a good conversation and will work together, which seems to signal that Pence, is not likely to take up the 25th Amendment, that they are going to try and see this through.
I want to pick up on several of the things that you just said, Catherine Lucey. So what has the president actually been doing since last Wednesday, this attack on the U.S. Capitol? How has he been spending his day?
He's been holed up. He has, he's only at this point, and even before the riot, the number of people around him that he was talking to, the number of people in the West Wing that he was seeing, had really shrunk to a very small group of advisors. So he spent Wednesday, watching this unfold. He spent a lot of Wednesday frustrated with his vice president for not, trying to reject the results as he had been openly pushing him to do. He had to really be urged by staff to make statements, about the attack. Eventually, coming Thursday in a statement, acknowledging that he would leave office. It was hard for them to get him to do these things. And we know that, in the days since, as I said, he has spent a lot of the weekend, sort of privately fuming, frustrated, feeling like, he is being wrongly treated. He is upset about losing his social media account and his Twitter account. That was a key way that he communicated with his supporters. And looking ahead, that raises real concerns for him about how does he continue to play a sort of leading role in his party, or, how does he continue to, have his, his political future? What does that mean for that?
Who has influence over the president at this point? As you said, he was sort of pressured into making some statements, but who's been able to convince him to do that? Because clearly he doesn't look like he wants to.
We know he's been talking to a number of people, inside and outside the White House. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy reached out to him on during the attacks to talk to him. He is talking to some advisors in the White House. Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, said yesterday that he had been speaking with him. So he's talking to some people, but they have been hard to get him to do many of these things. He is also this week likely to continue There's speculation that he will continue to issue, you know, pardons potentially. That's one thing that he might do with his final days in office. He has also gave the Presidential Medal of Freedom yesterday to a congressional ally. So he could continue to use the powers of the presidency in that way, his executive powers in these closing days.
I read that Kevin McCarthy actually had a conversation with the president saying, it's over.
Yeah, Kevin McCarthy has definitely been in touch with him. And Kevin McCarthy himself is in a very challenging position with his caucus. One of the things we really need to remember here as we see the footage of what happened and sort of process what happened last week is that for members on both sides of the aisle, this was very personal. This was where they work. This is where they were with their staff. They were concerned. They were worried they were going to be hurt. They were barricading doors. They were, you know, hiding under desks. So emotions are running very, very high. Republicans are, you know, divided over what to do. It's not clear how much Republican support there will be for any kind of impeachment effort. But there are some Republicans, you know, publicly calling on Trump. You know, and Senator Pat Toomey has been very critical. You know, there are Republicans saying that this is over and saying that the president should step aside.
Let me follow up on the president and the vice president. And while the Congress, the Capitol building was under attack and Vice President Pence was in hiding some safe place, the president was still tweeting pressure to get him to not certify the votes. And this has been a vice president so loyal to his boss. Help us understand, I guess it was a temporary rift, but what that rift was about in this relationship.
I mean, the pressure president, even as this attack unfolded, really capped an extraordinary campaign against his vice president in the days and weeks leading up to the certification of President-elect Biden's victory. The president kept pushing Pence, kept insisting that there were ways that he could reject these results. Finally, the vice president issued a letter to Congress ahead of the saying that they had done their own analysis, which is true. They had spent a lot of time looking at how the process actually worked, looking at what his role was, which truly was largely ceremonial. He conveyed this to the president as well privately, that he couldn't do this. And you saw him, he stayed in the Capitol sheltering, in a secure location throughout this attack, returned, when it was safe, and did oversee the proceedings and did ultimately certify the results. And this was something that, you know, that the, you know, people around the vice president felt really strongly that he was put in an impossible position here. He was being asked to do something, choose between his loyalty to the president and his, you know, need to adhere to the Constitution. And ultimately, he chose to, you know, make clear to the president that he was not going to do what he asked. And that infuriated the president. I mean, publicly and privately, he was furious. And he was still, as you said, tweeting at Pence even as this violence unfolded. And it was days before they spoke. We know that the vice president was upset also with how the president handled the violence, that he did not call on his supporters to immediately step down, to stop, that he didn't do more to try and halt this. But again, as I said earlier, they did finally meet yesterday. They are trying to, you know, put a united front on with the days left in this administration.
The president, President Trump, has said he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration. Is the vice president going to go?
He is expected to attend, yes. And I think the president-elect Biden has said that he is fine with Mr. Trump's decision not to attend.
Right. I heard that, yes.
Had not been expecting him to attend. People around him did not think that he was going to be participating, which is obviously tradition.
The House is going to vote on impeachment. And I mean, it looks like they have the votes. Is there anything, Catherine Lucey, that is up in the air as you look to Wednesday?
We expect that they have the votes. I think what we're trying to see now is how this process unfolds. You know, what happens? They expect to have the votes, but then it would have to go to the Senate. Right. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is saying there's no time for a trial before the inauguration. And so how the Senate trial and how that process would proceed and what that would look like, I think we're still trying to figure out. and you see Biden trying to figure out how he can start the business of being president, you know, if this was going on. He has been asking if they could, quote, bifurcate this process in the Senate and basically move forward with the impeachment while still allowing him to do some of the business of the first 100 days, like, you know, confirming his appointees. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
If the president is impeached tomorrow, and based on what you and others have said, Catherine Lucey, it looks like it will happen, that will be historic. It would be the first time a president has been impeached, not removed from office, but impeached by the House of Representatives.
This is a stunning moment for this presidency, which has been a presidency of many stunning moments. The fact that he is now, you know, they are barreling towards a second impeachment. And it follows a truly shocking attack on the U.S. Capitol. But, you know, multiple people were killed, people were put in danger. And that attack, I mean, as you know, and as your listeners know, follow the, weeks of the president, denying the election results, insisting that he had been defrauded, insisting that there were votes out there that were not counted, and holding a rally ahead of time, telling people to march to the Capitol, telling them to show strength. It is a really stunning moment in U.S. history.
I know there is pressure on the president to resign. That seems very out of character. I believe it was Senator Toomey and others have said, have asked him to do that. Do you think, Catherine, there's this any chance the president would resign in the next week or so? Or I guess it's this week, right?
We have heard no indication that the president would consider resigning. That's not something that, they have been talking about various scenarios and how this will play out. But so far, anyway, that does not appear to be something. And I think the comments yesterday about how he and the vice president plan to work together, the fact that they are trying to continue with some business, on this official trip to the border today, suggests that they are going to try and see this through.
And we're almost out of time here. Any traction on the 25th Amendment? Is that going to go anywhere, do you think?
As of right now, it doesn't appear so. We haven't heard anything from the vice president. He has not indicated that he supports that. You know, people close to him have suggested that's not something that they are looking to do. So as of right now, it appears more likely that we will move to tomorrow when they will take up impeachment.
And what do we know about January 20th? Will that be an outdoor event, inauguration, indoor? Is it still in flux?
I mean, as of right now, they are planning huge amounts of additional security are being added at the moment as they try and make sure that it is a safe event. The National Guard is adding more, more troops in the city. The Park Service has shut down tours. The mayor of D.C. yesterday asked people to stay away. And, so various precautions like that are being put in place to try and ensure that that this is a safe event.
Well, Catherine Lucey, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. She covers the White House for the Wall Street Journal. Coming up, Valerie Harrison and Catherine D'Angelo on their book, Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. What to say to children about the racial moment we're in? Last summer, there were Black Lives Matter protests across the country in response to police brutality sparked by the killing of George Floyd. And last week, a white mob, some carrying Confederate flags, stormed the U.S. Capitol, terrorizing the legislators, staff, and security inside. A noose and a gallows were constructed outside the complex. This can be a teachable moment for parents, and for non-Black parents raising Black children, it's a conversation freighted with our history of racism. Our guests, Valerie Harrison and Catherine D'Angelo, are authors of Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces, published by Temple University Press. They're longtime friends, and their book is about Catherine and her husband, who are white, adopting a biracial child, Gabriel. Valerie, Aunt Val to Gabriel, is black, and together they share their personal experiences with race. They also offer guidance about how to raise children of color with a strong sense of identity and belonging. And they join us on Radio Times to talk about their book and much, much more. Catherine D'Angelo is Temple University's Assistant Vice President of Administration and Planning. And Katie D'Angelo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype is Valerie Harrison. She's an attorney, and she's Senior Advisor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at Temple University. And Valerie Harrison, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Marty, thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. Before we get to your book, and frankly, the interview that I wrote up a couple of days ago, I do want to talk to you about this moment of racial reckoning that we're in after Wednesday's attack on the U.S. Capitol. And I'm just curious, and perhaps I'll put this to you, Valerie Harrison, how are you processing this moment or these moments that we're in?
You know, Katie and I have talked a lot about race and racism over the years, and particularly now since Gabe is in our lives, we are concerned about its impact on children. You know, we believe that it is critical to help Black children understand that when they're treated differently or badly, or when they see gatherings and messaging cloaked in racism, that they understand that it's not because something is wrong with them and that it's not new. And so we are committed, and Do Right By Me is committed to helping readers and particularly young people understand that message.
Yeah. And to you, Katie D'Angelo, Gabriela is nine. Children these days, they know a lot about what's going on in the world. Has he seen these news accounts? Has he seen the videos? How have you talked to him about this, what happened last week?
Sure. Well, and sadly, the events of last week are not really unlike the conversations we've been having with Gabriel about living through a pandemic, seeing a white police officer murder George Floyd, and the ways that our family participates in peaceful protests. You know, the single most important thing for Gabe to know is that he is safe, and we do everything in our power to reassure him of that. But we also make sure that the best information and source of truth is coming from us. So this means curating and moderating his access, you know, to the news and media. And the goal isn't to keep him from information, but making sure that we as his parents are a part of it.
Has he had specific questions or is there moments when you feel like he really is struggling to understand something?
Sure. Well, and I think what helps us is that we've been able to anchor everything with our values and beliefs. So, you know, the information, again, at age nine and how things get processed, you know, Gabe knows, I mean, at nine, that there's no punishment for being racist. You know, it carries the same outcome as being deemed not nice. And so in our home, kindness is the golden rule. So you can imagine this leads to daily conversations about what kindness means, what it looks like, the importance of accountability when we miss the mark. So no, this is not a one-time conversation. You know, each of these moments, including last week, has given us another opportunity to practice for the next conversation.
Valerie Harrison, let me pick up on that. And I think even beyond parents and children, I mean, it's time for an honest reckoning, an honest conversation for all of us to have. I wonder if you could speak to that, and then I do want to talk about the book.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yes, as I mentioned earlier, we want young people and readers to know that, again, when you see this, it's not new. You know, it's because despite the fact that humans are virtually 100% the same genetically, a false story was devised by ruling class interests, at least in the U.S., that paleness equals superiority. We want Black children to understand that worth was then attached and opportunities provided simply based on how someone looked in a way that unfairly disadvantaged Black individuals and communities and unfairly advantaged white individuals and communities. And we are committed to helping Black children understand that this resulted in a U.S. system of slavery and of legally mandated discrimination that followed, and that the false story still impacts the overall quality of life for most Black people. Even today, you know, there are policies and practices today that continue to produce disadvantage for Black people in a variety of areas, you know, education, employment, even healthcare, for example. And so what happened in 2020 and in the first few weeks of 2021 really shined a light on what we knew. In Do Right By Me, there is a chapter on healthcare disparities, for example. COVID-19 was another example of Black people disproportionately impacted by disease. You know, African Americans are getting sicker and dying at disproportionately higher rates from COVID-19 for a number of complex reasons, but that also include racism.
Let me talk about Gabriel, and I'll talk to you, Catherine. He's your son. He was born in 2011, so he's 9 years old. Tell us about him. What is he like?
Well, he's amazing.
Spoken like a truth. How do we interpret that?
He is absolutely incredible, as you would expect any mom to say about her 9-year old. And of course, as Aunt Vival will tell you, you know, he is a beautiful biracial boy, and he is also being raised by two sort of older white parents. And so, you know, we not only have been pouring everything into him, but we also, you know, we were really lucky to have his Aunt Vival, not only, you know, sowing her wisdom and love and support into me and my husband, Mike, but, you know, sowing her wisdom into our entire family. So, you know, really, one of the things that I think is most important about our conversation and about the process of the book is that this book ended up being so much about self-discovery and then developing relationships and the kinds of relationships that will cultivate and nurture our family and our son.
And I do want to talk to Valerie Harrison or Aunt Val, but let me go back to you, Katie. Did you and your husband, you wanted a transracial adoption? That was something you were seeking out?
So what we knew was that we were ready to be parents. You know, we were ready to welcome another member into our family of two. This opportunity to be considered as adoptive parents, we went through the process that, you know, I'm sure any adoptive parents can describe to you.
Sure.
But I think what's really also important, especially when it comes to the conversation around transracial adoption, you know, as Val and I dove into the research for this book, I really began to understand the National Association of Black Social Workers' position in 1972, advocating for Black children remaining in Black families. And their chief concern was that white families might lack the resources and the knowledge to equip a Black child to develop positive racial identity and navigate life in a racist society. And so as the white mother to my Black son, you know, it's clear to me that white parents must want to teach and show their child how to develop positive racial identity and how to effectively cope with issues of race and racism.
Let me pick up on that with you, Valerie Harrison, and Aunt Val, I should say, is what Gabriel calls you. But you say a really interesting thing about sort of, you know, I hate to sort of talk in broad sweeping statements, but Black families and kind of Euro white families and their view of family. But you say there are differences, and it's important to understand those.
There are, and you know, in terms of the National Association of Black Social Workers, as Katie has mentioned, the issue that we've learned over the years was not that there's anything wrong with or harmful with transracial adoption in and of itself, but that Black children do best when they have positive racial identity or when they feel good about the group that they're in. And that, on the other hand, confusion about racial identity is linked to psychological distress. And so in the book, we go back and forth about how we define, for example, a Black family. Mm-hmm. And we come to the conclusion that we use the term Black to define a child who has at least one black parent of African descent, because the world will probably regard that child as black. And that child then needs to be equipped with the tools to navigate racism and the burden of that identity in this society.
I'm thinking, Katie, though, going back to this, I just found it interesting, and I hadn't frankly thought of it quite the way the both of you write about family, that largely for white families, it's kind of the nuclear family, you know, who's related to who. And again, largely speaking, in a lot of African-American families, it's more relationship and less about biology. Can you speak to that, Kate?
Sure. And actually, that's one of the great gifts of my learning and my process. We say in the book that, frankly, my Eurocentric view of family, and that it was just me, Mike, and a child, perhaps, that was defining my family, that belief wasn't really doing me any good. It was very limiting and it was very narrow. And so among the many gifts of Gabriel becoming our son, it opened us up to the very, frankly, warm embrace of Black family and Black community that, you know, I can't stress this enough. Aunt Vival and the significance of that relationship, and just being embraced by people who know Gabriel, meet Gabriel, and then say, we've got you. And, you know, again, to the point of developing positive racial identity, whether the parents are white or black, what we know and the research supports is that black children thrive when their parents develop positive racial identity and then equip the child for how to thrive. So you're exactly right. By expanding and opening ourselves up to what is good and the possibility of just how expansive our family and community of support was, it has done nothing but helped make Mike and I better parents. And that makes us better for Gabriel.
Sure. I mean, is that the village, Valerie Harrison, that we talk about, the village?
It is. It is. Part of what Do Right By Me does is to try to help families understand different cultures, right? And to understand that a white or European worldview, you know, culture, value system, hair texture, all of that is just one among many. It's not a universal standard. It's just different. But it's not entitled to supersede others. And so we share what would be a traditional African and Black perspective on family, which is much broader than a nuclear family. And it includes those who may not be biologically tied or related, but who relationally are. And so we try to live out these principles in front of Gabe and in front of others.
Katie, you tell a really interesting story. I think Gabriel is about 4 years old, and you sign him up to play in a soccer league. And it turns out to be an all-white soccer league, and he holds back. Tell us what this incident revealed to you.
Sure. So this was actually among the first of many occasions when Mike and I recognized deeply and even painfully what it must feel like to look different. So again, as white parents, Mike and I have had a lifetime of experiences in predominantly white spaces. And so we've never known that feeling, you know? And so as a parent, it's a lot to take in, where Gabriel at the age of 4, it was our first time trying out soccer. And we marched onto the field and we observed it. Mike and I did, but Gabriel at age 4, shockingly, picked up immediately that he was the only child of color, including coaches and parents. He was the only one of about 100 people on the field. Wow. And so, you know, again, as a parent, that is a lot to take in, but particularly when the science explains that, you know, whether we've been punched in the stomach or wounded by direct or indirect marginalization, our brain pathways will set off an alarm that activates pain. And that, again, we are experiencing that pain of exclusion all the way in everywhere in our body. So, you know, coupling this with the research, it's why, you know, belonging and exclusion fundamentally impact us as human beings. Yeah. So when we see this experience, the boys on the soccer field don't even have to set out to exclude Gabe, right? Exclusion doesn't need to be practiced in order to be felt. And so all he had to do was observe that he looked different, and he's going to feel left out.
Yeah,
and he articulated that to us very clearly at the age of four.
Yeah, he says none of the other kids look like me. And what we should add is you found a different soccer group where he felt like, yeah, some of these kids look like me.
Absolutely. And again, immediately jumped in and felt a part of the action. And so again, and this is something that we really draw and spend some time on, that inclusion is not the absence of exclusion. It's its own practice. Everyone on that field that day went out of their way to try to make Gabe feel welcome and a part of it, and that they just wanted him to come and play and have fun. But really, he didn't need to experience explicit unwelcome to feel like he didn't belong.
I wonder, Valerie, if you could speak to that. We're coming up at a break here, but just this, I mean, I think it is a kind of universal desire to be accepted, to feel part of the group.
Absolutely. And so, for example, Black transracial adoptees tell us, you know, for white parents, for example, your child should not be your first Black friend. There needs to be a community of others who you see who look like you. And so we've included a chapter on developing friendships across races, for example, because we believe that that's also critical to a child's nurturing and development.
And that is Valerie Harrison, also with us at Catherine D'Angelo. And we're talking about their new book, just published by Temple University Press, called Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, especially if this is your experience. We want to hear from you. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-94. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Valerie Harrison and Catherine D'Angelo about their new book, Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces. They are longtime friends and colleagues, and their book is about Catherine and her husband, who are white, adopting a biracial child. Valerie is Black, and together they share their personal experiences and offer some guidance about how to raise Black children in white worlds with a strong sense of identity and belonging. There was an area of contention, as you write in this book. And Valerie, let me turn first to you. We've done whole hours on Black hair, but there was some disagreement, or not disagreement, but just sort of this was an issue between you and Katie D'Angelo about Gabriel's hair. What was at stake here, Valerie, for you?
Yeah, I'll tell you what was at stake, right? You know, like most developing friendships, you know, Katie and I over the years had engaged in a range of topics, from how to deal with relationships to our values to race and racism. But when Gabriel came on the scene in 2011, you know, the stakes grew from two friends engaging in really philosophical and academic conversations to a white mother trying to equip a Black child to thrive in a white environment, and then a community trying to support her. And conversations about race can be difficult. And so over the years, we have learned to disagree in a way that's not fatal to the relationship, because we're committed to keeping the priority really the priority, which is Gabe's health and welfare and our friendship. And so while we agree on most things, we disagreed on Gabe's hair. You know, I grew up as a Black woman in tradition that little boys get their hair cut at a barber shop shortly after their first birthday. You know, it's like a ritual, almost a rite of passage. And the barbershop is more than a place where hair is groomed. You know, it's a place where stories can be shared across generations and dreams are developed and encouraged. And Katie's position was that Gabe should have more freedom in terms of his hair. And so we went back and forth. And so while I'm here to be a support and a resource, at the end of the day, she is his mother. And decisions involving him, even his hair, are hers and Mike's. But with that being said, she ultimately cut his hair when he was 7. So we won at the end of the day. Anyway.
So you, but it took you a while to get there, right, Valerie?
It did.
Not to spend the rest of the show talking about hair, but it's important, and it's a lot about identity and culture and history and all that. Kay, do you want to weigh in on this at all?
She did win. Aunt Vival did win in the end. And I think what's really critical is, again, this comes back to how much we appreciate those like Aunt Vival who have poured into us and have taught us the significance and the importance of this. And so much of the ritual and identity through hair has everything to do with developing positive racial identity. And so that's also top of the list in terms of the things that we need to do for him and how we support him. And again, it's why we can safely have these conversations. But again, because of the relationship with Val and I, it's not fatal to the relationship. And I think more than anything in the past year, what we have learned is that conversations, even though they may be uncomfortable and even though they may test the things that are our values and our belief systems, we still have to have the conversations.
Well, this is jumping ahead, but maybe it's not too early, but I'm thinking, Valerie Harrison, about the talk, you know, that Black parents mm-hmm. have to have with their children about how to behave, you know, out in the world, especially if you're being followed in a store or you're being pulled over by the police. When is that an appropriate conversation, and how do white people have that conversation with a Black child, white parents with a Black child? Is it a different conversation?
And it's not. Katie and I, there's a chapter devoted to that in the book, and it gets back to an earlier point that we made, is that we think it's critical that Black children understand that there is nothing wrong with them, but that there is an unfortunate history that has resulted in them being viewed as an immediate threat or a danger through no fault of their own. We talk a lot about images and the role of images. And so part of our recommendations involve limiting exposure to negative and imbalanced images of yourself, and then to saturate young Black children with positive and balanced images, because there is a real risk that Black children, when they see negative images of themselves, that they will copy that behavior. And so part of our recommendations, again, involve replacing the negative and imbalanced images really with positive images and knowledge of Black history, of Black culture, of a legacy of resistance and resilience. But there is a practical aspect to this. And again, in the book, we lay out the practical aspects of having a conversation while not guaranteeing safety, that we believe will help keep young people mm-hmm. safe.
You know, Katie, there's a part where you talk about both you and your husband, you know, sometimes you'll get angry about a situation or you will, mm-hmm. you know, lose your temper in public. And you write about the fact that you, as a white person, you can, and probably as a white woman, you can do that without mm-hmm. worrying about some kind of a violent pushback, but maybe not true for Gabe, or probably, or most notably, not, this is not going to be true for your son, Gabriel.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as white parents, I can absolutely assure you, you know, Marty, you're right. My husband and I have nearly never had to consider how someone else felt about us. And as Gabe approaches double digits and he edges further from cute in a white person's eyes, I grow increasingly anxious about preparing him, knowing that my desire to insulate him in my privilege would and will misguide him as he faces the challenges ahead. I mean, every parent wants to protect their child from discomfort and keep them safe. However, what we know is that Gabe will have to regularly endure a range of situations because of the color of his skin. You know, the often daily indignities will range from questions like, why do you talk white, to the guaranteed encounter with a white woman who will clutch her purse at the sight of him. And I think the hardest part as a white parent to accept and understand is that in each case, he, as the brown body, will be responsible for making the adult feel comfortable. And he will be responsible for getting out of the situation safely. And that is very, very hard for any parent of a child to accept or understand.
Yeah. Valerie, if I can go back to you, and it's as I was reading your book, I'm also reading Barack Obama's memoir. And, you know, here he is again, another biracial child raised by a white mother and white grandparents. And there are many things, and obviously, you know, an extraordinarily accomplished person. But nonetheless, he does write about sometimes little small slights or noticing someone's smile changing.
Right.
Based on some conversation or something that happens. And it really struck me that, and here he is, a completely grown man, but he has some of those memories of some of those early childhood and adolescent experiences, how powerful they are.
It is. And, you know, Katie makes the point in the book that unlike parents who buy into a more colorblind or post-racial ideology, you have to confront head on the fact that you have to equip your child, and she has to equip Gabe for an experience that's much more complex than anything she has ever experienced. It could range from the microaggressions, as some people call them, the small slights, the daily indignities, to looking down the barrel of a gun of a police officer who views you as an immediate threat. And so that has been the motivation for us in writing the book. Just the urgency and the significance and the importance of helping, again, young people develop a positive racial identity and to be equipped to navigate racism.
But Katie, and to both of you, I get the feeling this can be done. I mean, it requires a lot of intention and, education and awareness, but it can be done.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the titles that we considered for the book, it's actually the title of our last chapter, and it's The Alchemy of Intention. Mm-hmm. And intention is exactly the place we kept coming back to as we were working through drafts of the book. This can be done well. And, you know, I know it's a very hard topic, but one of the things is that I hope we communicate our hope and promise throughout, because there is. I mean, you know, you had asked me in the beginning, tell us a little bit about Gabriel. I mean, he is bold. He is thriving. He has an incredible sense of humor.
That'll take him far, by the way. Yes.
and that's really what motivates me. Certainly it's what motivates Mike. I mean, we get to see every day the fruits of intention.
Let me read a comment from Kenny, and Valerie, I'll give you a chance to respond. He says, Kenny says, as one of two white parents with a black daughter who's almost 9, just like Gabe, I want to thank the guest for writing a book that supports parents like us. We have learned so many lessons mentioned over our daughter's life so far, and it continues to be part of every decision we make. We're not parents like white parents of white children. There's another layer of everything we do. While it is work, learning to parent a black child has been the most enriching experience of my life. That's from Kenny. Valerie, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, oh, that is beautiful. And Katie makes the point in the book as well that Gabe is actually a gift. She says she would like to believe that she would have been a person who would have had the desire to go deeper into issues of race and racism and racial equity. But had it not been for Gabe, she's not sure if she would have. And so we hear these same concerns expressed by Katie and by the caller. I thank him for that at conferences and meeting from white parents of black adopted children. And, you know, they share concerns about everything from, again, hair. Hair is a big thing, particularly for girls. And affirming body image, how to build a diverse community where Black achievement is the norm. Not so much from television images, but that they can actually have people in their community of support. And so it was clear to Katie and me from her experience and the experience of those who would speak to us that parents of Black children want badly to parent well, but they have real questions about their ability to navigate these issues of racism, of culture and identity. And so we are hopeful that Do Right By Me equips parents to do that great work.
I'm not sure how to ask this question, but Katie, I want to toss it to you about it being a white parent raising a Black child. So is everything about race? Are there issues, moments when it's not about race?
Sure. That's a great question. And I have to be very honest with you. It's a constant question because I need to always hold that in check, you know, and how am I seeing things? I think one of the things, and I really appreciate Kenny's comment, because it not only has made us better human beings, you know, the gift of becoming a parent, certainly, but I'm doing my work. You know, every day is a question of you've got to do your own work. And so I'm confronted constantly now about looking at the question of race and checking my own life experience to say, how would this have played differently if my skin color were not white? So, you know, we have over 400 years of history in this country that tells me not only have I never had to think about race and what it might be doing, but I certainly have never been expected to confront the possibility that race could be affecting the life of a Black child. So it's hard now. It's one of those things where it's like, once you see it, you know, those puzzles where once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yes. The picture in the face or something. Yes.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, what I am keenly aware of is that the systems and policies of racism were carefully designed by white people to protect and reinforce these unearned privileges for the benefit of white people. So it's a daily exercise for me to look and say, is this race or not? And, you know, by way of an example, what I've observed both personally and professionally is that many white people won't work to change a system that works for them. And, you know, all of these systems were designed to benefit me and my white husband. But they certainly were not designed to benefit my son.
Yeah. Yeah. We're almost out of time here. Valerie Harrison, I'm giving you the last word. Any final thoughts?
Well, I'd like to follow up on that. And thank you so much for that question.
Sure.
We really want, again, we are challenging really the colorblind and post-racial ideologies. And we want parents to understand that race does impact the life and the lives of Black children in a way that I think that white parents had not considered before. We have a chapter on education. You have to think about lower teacher expectations for Black children in a way that you would not, perhaps, if you did not have a Black child in that school. In terms of employment, the bias that a white student or adult may encounter in the criminal justice system, we don't need to explain much about that because we see it playing out in the news all the time. And even in healthcare, we have a chapter on that. In presenting a Black child to the ER, there are some concerns that you would have that you would not have if your child were white. And so we just want to challenge and push parents a bit to move beyond a colorblind ideology. The best schools, the best neighborhood, all the love in the world may not be enough.
Well, we got to leave it there. Valerie Harrison, Catherine D'Angelo, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And their book is called Do Right By Me, Learning to Raise Black Children in White Spaces. And Catherine D'Angelo is Temple University's Assistant Vice President of Administration and Planning. And Valerie Harrison is a Senior Advisor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at Temple University. And Temple University Press published their book. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.